Okay, children, I'm going to start off with a question for you. I want you to answer out loud, okay? And there's more than one part to this. Do you know what a nativity scene is? You know what that is? There's usually little figures relating to the birth of Jesus. Sometimes there's a little shed there. Well, tell me what figures you see in a nativity scene. What's there? The baby Jesus, Mary and Joseph, the shepherds, what? An angel? What else? The wise men, they actually come later. Usually they're there. They're there. I always put them on the other side of the room just to let us know that they're not quite there yet. And there's some animals, right? Right? There's some animals there. But there's something you didn't tell me. What about the dragon? Don't you have a dragon in your nativity scenes? No? Well, you know, maybe we should have a dragon in our nativity scenes. You know, if you listen to the message today, perhaps we will find out why we should all add dragons to our nativity scene. Now, if you're here last night, you're probably thinking there's a dragon theme going here. This may be because Matthew and I have been watching the Hobbit movies lately, and we've seen Smaug, but hang with me here. Now, we usually turn to Matthew or Luke to review their accounts of Jesus' birth, and it's a good thing to do. We heard those passages last night in our Christmas Eve service. But on this Christmas day, we're going to consider another biblical perspective on that great historical event. It is found in that last cryptic book of the Bible, the book of Revelation. In John's Patmos vision, we have words about the birth of Jesus. But they are not words of narrative description such as we find in the Gospels. Instead, they are words that speak of the cosmic context of Christmas. In just a few syllables, we are invited to view the birth of Jesus from the standpoint of God's plan for all the ages, to see that birth as a pivotal point in the spiritual warfare that constitutes all history since man fell into sin. We will see that all of human history is the story of a dragon seeking to attack a damsel in distress, a damsel who is waiting for a hero to arise and save her. And that's going to provide the 3 points for our message today. First of all, we're going to consider the damsel in distress in verses 1 and 2. Secondly, the fiery dragon in verses 3 and 4. And then the hero in verses 5 and 6. So we want to work our way through this passage to learn about the attack of the dragon, the story of Christmas in Revelation. Now, the first of the characters we meet is the damsel in distress in verses 1 and 2. Hear verse 1 again. Now, a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Now, in this first verse of chapter 12, we have this phrase, a great sign. The word sign appears 7 times in Revelation, but this is only one of 2 places where we have a great sign. And this tells us that what is signified here is something of great importance. It's something we need to understand. Well, what is this great sign? Well, we're told it is a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Now, when we come to passages like that, especially in Revelation, we sort of tend sometimes to just read right through them, keep on reading, but I want to stop. And I want to use your imagination. We're given a description here. Picture this scene. There's a woman. What is she wearing? She's wearing the sun. And she has a garland on her head that's made of 12 stars. And she's standing atop the moon. Have you ever seen that? No. It's a rather odd image. And the unusual nature of this image reminds us that the book of Revelation is filled with symbolism. Symbolism that is drawn from the Old Testament. So what I want us to do is put on our biblical thinking caps and consider this woman and her odd apparel. Whenever we encounter the number 12, our biblical mindset should take us back to the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, is there some place in the Old Testament where the 12 tribes are related to 12 stars, the sun, and the moon? Well, there is. Genesis 37 records Joseph, the son of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, telling his 11 brothers about his dreams in which they show subservience to him. And we read in verse 9 of that chapter, "Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, 'Look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me.'" And the text goes on to tell us Joseph's 11 brothers were pictured as stars, his father Jacob as the sun, and his mother Rachel as the moon. Now, taking Joseph along with his brothers as a star, we have all the elements of our picture from Revelation present. There's 12 stars, there's the sun, and the moon. We know that these sons of Jacob would become the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel, God's corporate people under the old covenant. And this symbolism points to the fact that this woman represents the people of God. But why a woman? In various places in the Old Testament, Israel is portrayed as a woman, more specifically, as God's wife. Consider the Lord's words to his people through the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 54. "For your maker is your husband, Yahweh of hosts is his name, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. He is called the God of the whole earth, for Yahweh has called you like a youthful wife." And you may recall that very often the prophets rebuke Israel for being an unfaithful wife to the Lord, of being guilty of spiritual adultery. The whole book of Hosea is dedicated to that theme. But remember that Israel can only be an unfaithful wife because she is, first of all, a wife. That is, metaphorically, spiritually, a wife of the Lord. Well, verse 2, "Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth." And here we learn that this woman, this damsel, is in distress. It's distress related to giving birth. And if we are to understand Israel as the corporate people of God, to be symbolized by the woman, what is meant by this description of her pregnancy and labor pains? Again, we could ask, was Israel ever portrayed as a pregnant woman? And again, the answer is yes. This can be found in several passages, most notably from Micah 4. Micah 4:10 tells us, "Be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion." Daughter of Zion is the people of Israel. "Like a woman in birth pangs, for now you shall go forth from the city and dwell in the field, and to Babylon you shall go." And the prophet proceeds to speak of nations rising against the woman Israel, who will find ultimate victory when she gives birth. Micah 5, verse 2, a portion of which we read today, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from of old, from everlasting. Therefore he shall give them up until the time that she who is in labor has given birth. Then the remnant of his brethren shall return to the children of Israel." Micah's prophecy pictures a woman in labor whose deliverance from oppression will finally come when she gives birth, a birth that will take place in Bethlehem. You begin to see how Revelation is alluding here to the birth of our Savior. Now, after encountering the damsel in distress, we see another sign in the next verse in Revelation 12. That brings us to our second point, the fiery dragon. Verse 3, "And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head." The next sign introduces the next character in the drama. It's this great fiery dragon. He has 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 diadems on his head. Try to picture that in your mind. We've seen dragons, perhaps in movies. This one has 7 heads, and each head has a crown, and there's 10 horns. It's another strange image, to be sure. But again, let's put our biblical thinking caps on. And when we do, we may remember that imagery in Daniel 7 is very similar to the picture of this dragon. In Daniel, we read of a succession of 4 beasts who between them have 7 heads, the number of heads of this dragon. The 4th beast in Daniel 7 has 10 horns, also like the dragon. The beast in Daniel represent a succession of world empires, each of which persecutes God's people. Now, keeping that in mind, John does not leave us to wonder at the ultimate identity of this dragon. He writes just a few verses later in verse 9, "So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan." So who is this red fiery dragon? It's the ancient serpent. It's the devil. It's Satan. And this figure recurs throughout the Old Testament. For example, the Egyptian pharaoh is spoken of as the great dragon in Ezekiel. And throughout the Old Testament, rulers and empires opposed to God and his people are referred to as dragons and as monsters, like we saw in Daniel 7. This dragon's color is red, like the red horse of Revelation 6:4, whose rider takes peace away from the earth and fosters bloodshed. This is the dragon's goal in dealing with the woman, God's people, to destroy her. And he wears seven diadems, seven crowns of arrogated authority. The great red dragon is thus an image of Satan as the powerful oppressor of God's people, often manipulating human rulers to accomplish his purpose. And his purposes achieve a focal point in the next verse, verse 4. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. The language of casting down stars from heaven is drawn from Daniel 8, where we read of the actions of one that rises up. It cast down some of the host of heaven and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Now in Daniel, this was a prophecy of the persecution of God's people that found initial fulfillment through the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century B.C. But Revelation is showing that the power behind this earthly persecutor and others like him is Satan himself. Thus, this vivid image of the dragon sweeping down the stars with his tail. And remember, the 12 stars are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is a picture of Satan, again, persecuting God's people. And that persecution reaches a particular focus. And the dragon stood before the woman who is ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. Here now, the dragon is brought into proximity to the damsel in distress. And when we remember that the dragon is the ancient serpent, this passage causes us to think back to the serpent's confrontation with Eve in the Garden of Eden. There he led her and Adam into sin that cast all humanity into ruin. But what was the Lord's response to Satan's deception of the woman? Well, the Lord speaks a prophecy to this ancient serpent dragon in Genesis 3:15. He says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." Now that's the first proclamation of the gospel. The Lord declares that human history will unfold as a conflict between the seed of the woman, those who are faithful to God, and the seed of the serpent, those who are faithful to Satan. And in this conflict, Satan will inflict injury and pain, bruising the heel of the seed of the woman, but ultimately, the seed of the woman will prevail by crushing the head of the serpent. And this points us to the fact that the image of a woman for God's people traces back even further than the 12 tribes of Israel. It predates even the covenant promises to Abraham. It goes all the way back to this promise after the fall. That is when Satan's conflict with a woman began. And that conflict is the explanation for Satan imploring world rulers and empires to persecute the people of God. He is ever trying to destroy the godly seed of the woman. And let's consider just a few instances of this throughout sacred history. That dragon, Satan, inspired Cain to kill Abel in an attempt to wipe out the godly seed. It could be that he thought he had won that final victory quickly when Abel died, but God carried on the godly seed by raising up Seth. The dragon, Satan, was most effective at corrupting Seth's godly line. By the time of Noah, there's only one righteous man left on the face of the earth. Surely victory seemed at hand for Satan. If he could just wipe out Noah, the godly line would be extinguished. Yet God stepped in, saved Noah through the flood, by which he poured out judgment on the ungodly seed of the serpent. God makes great covenant promises to Abraham that would be realized through his seed, his descendants. Yet Sarah is barren, and the dragon Satan may well have seen in her barrenness a hope that the seed of the woman would be cut off, that that divine promise could never be fulfilled. And he could only have been encouraged when Abram took things into his own hands and had a son through Sarah's maidservant Hagar. Yet God was faithful to his promise and overcame the barrenness of Sarah so that Isaac, the son of promise, might be born, and the dragon was thwarted again. Isaac's wife Rebekah was also barren, another damsel in distress. Once more, it looked like the godly seed might come to an end, but God overcame Rebekah's barrenness just as he had overcome Sarah's. And God was teaching his people a lesson through these things. He was fulfilling his promises in his might, not by human strength or ability. But still, the dragon Satan didn't give up. And he was behind that great dragon Pharaoh who tried to destroy the Israelites in Egypt. It was a devilish plot when Pharaoh commanded Hebrew midwives to kill all male Hebrew children at birth. And when that didn't work, it was the dragon's strategy that all males born would be cast into the Nile. He was again trying to cut off the seed of the woman. But God protected the future Redeemer of Israel by casting him into the Nile in a little ark. Thus, like Noah, Moses was protected in an ark. It's the very same word in Hebrew. He lived and grew up in the very palace of Pharaoh, later to lead God's people out of Egypt. The godly seed was not wiped out. History moves on, and the promise to raise up the ultimately victorious seed is narrowed to the tribe of Judah, from which arises the great King David. If David can be wiped out, Satan can have victory. Remember that Saul twice throws his spear at David in murderous rage, but David evades it both times. But that was not the end of Saul's hostility toward David. We read in 1 Samuel 18, "So Saul became David's enemy continually." You see, in the person of Saul, the dragon Satan had one of earth's mighty rulers under his control, but he was unable to cut off the godly seed by killing David. But there was still opportunity to cut off that seed. Athaliah, the daughter of wicked Ahab and Jezebel, came to power in Judah. The dragon Satan put it in her heart to maintain absolute power by destroying all the seed of David. We read in 2 Kings 11, "When Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the royal heirs." Sounds like the end of the story. The victory for Satan and the annihilation of David's seed. But then we read on. But Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the king's sons who were being murdered. And Joash would grow up to reign over Judah. The dragon Satan had not been able to cut off the seed of the woman by killing all the royal babies in David's line. Still later, when the Jews were in captivity, the dragon Satan sought to strike again. He inspired Haman to convince King Ahasuerus to issue a decree that all the Jews should be put to death throughout his vast kingdom. Could this then be Satan's means of cutting off the godly seed? No, because God raised up Esther for such a time as this, and her people, the Jews, the seed of the woman, were preserved. This conflict between the dragon, Satan, and the seed of the woman fills the pages of Old Testament history. Time and time again, Satan sought to employ rulers to cut off the seed of the woman, to bring an end to the godly line. Many times he did this by seeking to have babies killed. That is what Satan is like. The dragon is a baby killer. But over and over, God thwarted Satan's plans. To be sure, there was much persecution. This may be intimated by the birth pains of the woman in Revelation 12. Israel suffered greatly through the years as she awaited the birth of that final seed who would crush the head of the serpent. She was a damsel in distress. So we are not surprised at Satan's strategy as recorded in Revelation 12. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. And in the final analysis, this is a reference to Bethlehem, which we'll see clearly as we consider our next point, and that is the hero in verses 5 and 6. Verse 5, she bore a male child who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and his throne. Now here's the third character in our drama, a newly born man child. There can be no doubt about this identity of the child born of the woman. He is the one who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron. That's the messianic language of Psalm 2. That psalm speaks of the kings of the earth conspiring against Yahweh and his anointed. And we've seen that Satan is behind such conspiracies of evil power. Yet in the face of all their machinations, Yahweh laughs. He laughs at them because he has his own plan. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. And that king then speaks, I will declare to the decree, Yahweh has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. And in that prophecy, we have message that a hero is coming. The messianic king who will rule over the nations with a rod of iron is none other than Jesus. He is the male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron in Revelation 12:5. So it is of the birth of Jesus that we read. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. And that dragon, Satan, did try to devour the Christ child, didn't he? No, he didn't do it immediately on the day of Jesus' birth. But Satan employed one of his old strategies, pulling the levers of political power. When the wise men came to Jerusalem inquiring about the birth of a king of the Jews, Herod was troubled. He inquired of the chief priests and scribes where such a king was to be born, and they told him in Bethlehem, as prophesied by Micah. Herod sent the wise men on to Bethlehem with instructions to report back to him so that he could also go and worship him. Of course, he had no plans to worship the child. His designs were murderous, and the wise men were warned in a dream not to return to him. And this enraged Herod. Based upon when the wise men said they first saw the star, he realized the baby could be no older than 2 years. So Herod ordered all male children, 2 and under, in the environs of Bethlehem to be slaughtered. Echoing the earlier murder of male infants in Egypt, this was how the dragon Satan sought to devour the child born of the woman, but it didn't work. God had a plan to preserve the child, as recorded in Matthew 2. Now when the wise men had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, Arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, Out of Egypt I called my son. How ironic that the baby Jesus is spared from the slaughter of the innocents in Bethlehem by finding shelter in Egypt. Egypt was one of the great monsters and dragons in the Old Testament that Satan used to try to cut off the seed of the woman. But now it is in Egypt that final seed is kept safe. The utter failure of Satan's strategy is revealed by the way Revelation 12 moves instantly from Christ's birth to his ascension to heaven. She bore a male child, and her child was caught up to God and his throne. Now, it's not that Jesus' life and death are not important. We have plenty of testimony to those things in the Bible. But what is being revealed in Revelation 12 is the utter failure of Satan, the great fiery dragon, to devour the seed of the woman. He fails to do so at his birth, as we know he will fail to do so at his death. And so Jesus ultimately ascends to God's throne in heaven, the victorious hero. The results of Christ's ascension are unpacked in the remainder of chapter 12. We read in the next verse, verse 6, Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Now the church is God's new covenant people, the new Israel. As Israel was the wife of Yahweh in the Old Testament, so what is the church? The bride of Christ. And the church escapes to the wilderness where, like Elijah in the wilderness, she is nourished by the Lord. And the chapter goes on to relate how Christ's ascension meant the dragon Satan's eviction from heaven. Up until that time, he could appear there as an accuser of the saints. We get a picture of that in the opening chapters of the book of Job. Satan could enter God's presence and bring charges against his people, but that is no longer the case after the ascension of Christ. What accusation can Satan bring against God's people for whom the Lamb has shed his blood? He goes after the woman, but he cannot destroy her. How can he wipe out the church when Christ promised, "I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it"? But while Satan cannot destroy the church, he can persecute her. Revelation 12 closes by stating, "And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ." Now, people of God, the dragon Satan or his minions may attack you, but he cannot defeat you. Jesus, whom he could not devour as a baby, now reigns from his heavenly throne, subduing his enemies, building his church. Even when we are in the wilderness of suffering and persecution, God provides for us. And he also assures us that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. As Christmas season rolls around each year, read and rejoice in the narratives of Jesus' birth in the Gospels. Remember the marvelous Old Testament prophecies that are fulfilled in that birth. But remember also the cosmic context of Jesus' birth that is found in the book of Revelation. Ever since Eden, the great dragon Satan had tried to destroy the faithful line of the seed of the woman. Satan tried to cut it off before the ultimate seed arrived, who would crush his head. And that seed came in the person of a baby born in Bethlehem. The dragon Satan was there waiting, conspiring, manipulating human rulers once more in an attempt to devour this child and defeat the godly once and for all. But he could not destroy this man-child who escaped his clutches and ascended to heaven, the hero who has saved the damsel in distress. So maybe we should add a dragon to our nativity scenes, crouching somewhere, looking with an evil stare toward the baby Jesus. But let us remember that the book of Revelation tells us that Christmas is about the defeat of the dragon Satan and the preservation of the woman, that is, the church. And rejoice that you are part of that church through faith in the one who was born in a manger. Rejoice that your arch enemy has already been cast out of heaven and one day will be cast into the lake of fire forever. And rejoice that God has promised to provide for you, even in the midst of the suffering and persecution you still encounter in this life. Rejoice that in Christ you have begun a greater life, a life that will never end. Let us pray.